Okay, hi again, John Roby, a grad student here at Binghamton. While preparing this presentation, I ran across the story of Stephen and Catherine. They're a young couple in Las Vegas who lived together for several years. They make their living in the strip casinos in Vegas. Their home has most of what you'd expect in it. There's a bed, a kitchen area, books and CDs. It's the location that's striking to me. You see, Stephen and Catherine live underneath Caesar's Palace Casino. They live in this huge network of flood control tunnels that undergird Las Vegas, them and about 700 other people. There's no electricity, there's no running water, there are plenty of black widow spiders, and on average, one person a year is killed when sudden rains lead to flash floods that wash people and things out of these tunnels. The couple's story illustrates the main themes that I want to discuss today, the destructive tropes of civilized life, and the possibility of archaeology contributing to a sort of productive destruction of these tropes. I'm going to try to sketch the margins of what I'm calling an anti-civilization archaeology, demonstrate its anarchist grounding, and using two examples, give a conceptual outline of what this sort of archaeology might look like in practice. A huge caveat to start with. I'm going to be treating some things as assumptions that really deserve sustained investigation of the kinds that have been referenced by the other papers today. This paper is about ideas, directions, and possibilities, and my thinking here is still very much in development. When I talk about civilization, I'm talking about something very specific and wide-ranging. This is a loaded concept, so I want to define the margins of what I'm talking about here very carefully. I'm talking about civilization broadly as the emergence of a distinction between the self and the earth. It's not a thing, it's an orientation, a mindset based on control of the natural world and its inhabitants, human and non-human. Domestication is one main means of the civilization, one main mechanism. Controlling, taming, breeding, and modifying life, including human life, for human benefit. Power is a constantly present idea in this notion of domestication, through such things as technology and hierarchical social institutions. More narrowly, though, civilization is the logic, institutions, and physical apparatus of domestication, control, and domination. Warfare, class division, gender subjugation, drudge work, property, hierarchy are a few of its many derivatives. They're important and they're worth investigating, but they're not prior to a civilizing logic. Rather, they're elements of a larger, unified scheme of control. Civilizations, I'm using it here, it's not natural, necessary, or evolutionary. It doesn't necessarily look the same everywhere, but its impacts and derivatives are depressingly consistent. Some of you probably picked up this understanding is informed in part by green anarchy. It's a broad grouping of ideas and perspectives that include such people as primitivists, technopositivists, neo-Luddites, and a lot of other of these kind of annoying labels. It's not my intention here to identify with any particular camp or to critique anyone in particular, but I find many of the shared values and ethics compelling and useful for this notion of an archaeology of civilization. In particular, the emphasis on questioning received notions, received social realities, resisting institutions of domination, values to small-scale community, examining the infrastructures and social systems that would sustain such a community, and investigating means of social organization that work with nature, not against it. So to sum, I'm treating civilization here as a conceptual model, the sum of the institutions of domination and control of humans and nature. In a way, I'm begging the question. It's not my intention to demonstrate this, although someone needs to work on these things, but to assume it as a way of situating the discussion that I really want to talk about. In this view, civilization is inherently destructive. It's not something that can be reformed. We don't need more morality, more legislation, more organization, more low-wattage light bulbs, more high-mileage cars. There are times and places when direct action against the mechanisms of civilization is appropriate and necessary. But there's also times and places where revealing its workings, demonstrating its historical nature, and questioning its taken for granted are the most useful actions. This is what an archaeology against civilization can do. By an anti-civilization archaeology, I'm talking about an archaeology that focuses on the destructive processes and trajectories of civilization, as well as an archaeology that works toward a climate where the dismantling of civilization itself is seen as necessary and proper. In an outstanding article that I recommend to everyone from 2008, Alfredo González Roybal The article is called Time to Destroy, an Archaeology of Supermodernity. Gonzalez Roybal outlines a program for an archaeology of supermodernity, an archaeology of the excesses and devastation brought on by the recent exaggeration of the destructive tendencies of modernity. Its location is the non-places, places of abjection, the places that are unconstituted, outside discourse. Places like battlefields, mass graves, slaughterhouses, post-industrial landscapes, squatters' camps, riot zones, toxic landscapes. These are the abject locales of supermodernity. They're not part of the consciousness because they're painful, immediate, and distasteful. Yet I argue that these locations where we can confront this supermodernity directly are a natural outcome of the rise of civilization. They're all residues of the civilizing logic that works to preserve itself through compelling the destructive domination of the human and non-human worlds. They have to be hidden from view because they're so repulsive. Attention to them forces one to confront the repulsive logic of civilization itself. Speaking of repulsive logic, we have a couple of images here. What is the task of an anti-civilization archaeology? It's not simply to tell more stories, to give more voices, to proliferate more facts. As archaeologists, we're trained to read material traces. We engage with qualities and textures of things. We study history and material culture. We have strong methods of documenting and interpreting the past. We reveal truths through many means, maps, drawings, graphs, etc. Gonzalez Roybal refers to this as making manifest these things that are unconstituted or outside discourse. This, I argue, is the strongest possible political act we can take as academics, revealing truths that allow the presencing of the repressed and the unsayable, unveiling what the civilizing power machine does not want to be shown. The basic method is to contextualize historical trends of the mechanisms of civilization, show their contingent nature, and think about their implications. This obviously cannot be innocuous or apolitical. The stakes are too high and the threat is too real. There is excellent and necessary work being done right now by forensic and bioarchaeologists investigating murders, mass graves, and battlefield sites. These are places of abjection, if ever there were any. Although important, most of this work does not fit a program of anti-civilization archaeology. It's not that it isn't political necessarily, but that the politics are misdirected. The knowledge that's created feeds into liberal democratic discourses of justice, human rights, war crimes, justifying the punishment of those who act against them, but never confronting the institutions and logic that sustain both sides of the equation. A similar criticism applies to Gonzalez Roybal's other work, his program for an archaeology of fascism. It's compelling, interesting work. He contrasts the daily banality of war with the fierce rhetoric. You're welcome. Of fascism through examining the still present detritus of the Italian fascist war in Ethiopia. But he doesn't go far enough. You can apply the same program to the liberal democratic state as well. Contrast the daily banality of working, eating, voting, consuming with the triumphalist rhetoric of economic growth, personal freedom, and political liberty. The civilizing logic of the liberal state permeates all aspects of life, from whom we can love, to where we can live, to how we can spend our time. When the logic fails to penetrate us, the civilizing mechanism steps in. The state establishes and guarantees justice and punishes those who transgress. It reserves a monopoly on legitimate use of force, hence the notion of war crimes, which implies the legitimacy of certain kinds of war. The state claims to care for those who have no power while reproducing power for the powerful. This is the civilizing function of one particular apparatus, the state, and it's sustained by the political right and left. A different paradigm is necessary to confront it. Whereas the left envisions a world that is run more equitably, the anarchist vision is of a world that doesn't need running. This running is where we get the tangible, destructive effects of the civilizing project. So that's where we can launch an anti-civilization archaeology. Its aim is to make manifest the roots and means of how the civilized world is sustained. It removes the false veil of banality from daily life and reveals the destruction underlying it all. The method is genealogical, historical, and multi-sided, and must begin in what is increasingly referred to as the contemporary past, from the beginning of the short 20th century to the very present. This presents several issues and opportunities. First, this recent past is characterized by a wild proliferation and dissipation of information and objects, for instance. Yet our attention is on those things that are inarticulate, non-discursive, otherwise unconstituted. The methods of archaeology put analytical distance between us and our objects. We measure, describe, photograph things. In this case, though, there's already distance there. We seek to make present that which is absent. The goal is to undistance our object of study, and by virtue of this act, to alter its nature. This is overtly political, and we have to embrace it. In addition, we need to recognize that that which is absent is not invisible. Rather, there's a tension between remembering and forgetting caused by what's not there. The adject is present in its absence. This makes our work possible, but complicates it. We have to first presence the absent. This is a radically different approach from archaeology's paradigm of discovery. We don't just find what's out there. We're, in essence, creating and investigating an object that might not be present in a material sense. Now I'm going to try to tie these threads together and show two examples of what an anti-civilization archaeology project might look like. For the first example, we're going to return to Stephen and Catherine in the tunnels below Las Vegas. Their story calls to mind Buckley and Lucas's archaeological investigation of the British Council House, think public housing in Britain. Both deal with people who are unconstituted as subjects, at least through state projects of documentation and record keeping. That's them. Both are objects of systemic indifference, abjected by the state and the community. What's important about both of these cases is that they are utterly necessary outcomes of the civilizing project. Civilization is built upon conflict, and it requires its antithetical figures. Under the logic of civilization, property and housing become a bludgeon used against the underclass. Those who don't work in order to consume fall outside of this logic. Of course, not all work and consumption are equal. Gambling your own money in the casinos is encouraged, but credit hustling, or checking slot machines for overlooked coins, like Stephen and Catherine do, is theft from the casinos. Let's consider that concept for a moment. Those who consume illegal drugs, like Stephen and Catherine, provide a different kind of service to the state by feeding the prison and police apparatus, giving a case study for those in power to highlight the supposed threat of those outside civilization. In this case, they and the others are literally pushed underground, ignored and minimized, abjected by the very project that requires them to function. Las Vegas is the glittering jewel of supermodern excess. Think back to that first picture. It makes sense as a starting point for an archaeology of civilization. We could choose to attack any one of several particular mechanisms: money and wages, population aggregation and the means of control it necessitates, environmental devastation, consumption and waste, and so on. I'm going to approach this sketch from the context of housing. The presencing, or the making manifest, according to Gonzalez-Roybal's model, begins if we were to enter the tunnels, to go as intruders into the spaces that civilization walls off. We would approach the abjected space as we would any other investigation, asking the questions that archaeologists ask of the data we're familiar with. What material remains do people leave in the tunnels? How do they establish a space for themselves? What can indicate who they are or who they've been made to become? We then expand from these spaces to compare and contrast the material culture of the tunnels and the civilized world above. How do these objects and images contrast with those of the tourists in Las Vegas, the casino workers, the construction laborers, and so on? This is the act of presencing. We force attention to inequalities of housing by taking an extreme example of lack and situating it against a backdrop of plenty for some, less for others. But it's one thing to simply document differences in living circumstances. Anthropology does this almost naturally. We have a tradition of critical inquiry that connects this sort of thing to markets, globalization, and so on. The task of the archaeology I'm talking about is to go further, to demonstrate that these social conditions are not natural or necessary, that the traditional evils of our field are all outgrowths of an oppressive civilizing system that overturned natural human relations. One means of doing this is by expanding through space and time, examining the issue, in this case housing, genealogically, from multiple sites. The assumption is that any particular practice doesn't appear out of whole cloth, but reiterates or recontextualizes practices that came before. A genealogical study of housing in a particular place would involve marshaling archaeological and anthropological evidence of the ways that people in that place have been housed back and back and back in time. We seek iterative connections between successions of practices and points when changes occur, and then attempt to link these points of change to broader social processes. This is obviously vastly oversimplified, but in essence, we would examine Las Vegas housing in sequence back to its founding, before its founding, and then look at housing among indigenous inhabitants of the area, genealogically. Do we find evidence of the same physical and social removal of large segments of society throughout history in prehistory? I suspect not, and I suspect I know why not. This allows us to raise the question of why, and opens the door to attack the logic of civilization. The second example revolves around industrial decline. An industrial economy is extractive and thus unsustainable. It requires labor to be divided, and thus pits bosses against workers, men against women, class against class. It creates products that require markets that must always expand, perpetuating the oppressive systems of money and property, and ensuring a steady supply of waste. In short, it's a tool of civilization, and like civilization, it's destroying itself. Our landscape is littered with its abject remains. An archaeology against civilization could approach the issue of industrialization in one of the Rust Belt cities where its effects are most keenly felt. Places like Flint, Michigan, Youngstown, Ohio, Detroit. You can see the image there. It's a comparison of one particular neighborhood in Detroit in 1961 and now. You can see the changes in the landscape there. All three cities are considering some form of consolidation. The details vary, but plans include raising entire neighborhoods, pulling up utilities, withdrawing services, essentially allowing vast tracts of the cities to rewild themselves. Metaphorically, the plan's a powerful commentary on industrial excess. On a practical level, it provides thousands of potential entry points for the sort of archaeology I'm outlining here. We can map property growth against industrial growth. We can talk to people with firsthand knowledge about the rise and fall of the local economies and how they experienced it. We can take advantage of CRM laws and build a case for historic building surveys, testing of these properties. We can go back in time through excavation, creating genealogical pictures of micro-level environmental changes, tropes of consumption and production, levels of waste discard, all these practices of daily life that we have the tools to tease out of the material record. But again, this isn't the end, but the beginning. If our assumption is that industrial decline is an outgrowth of civilization itself, we need to build multi-sided genealogical pictures of, at least, pre-industrial, industrial, and post-industrial locales. We need to show what Flint was like, for instance, in the present, at its height, during its rise, and before it was Flint, even before it was inhabited. This involves not just dirt archaeology, but digging documents as well, and is a project that should involve historians, sociologists, environmental experts, as well as activists, community members, and the general public. What sets us apart from archaeology grounded in other political frameworks is that it's not celebratory. It's not intended to create new stories. It's not reductive to a single ill of civilization. It's committed to making manifest one of the massive lies that sustain our drive to destruction. In sum, I've outlined here two potential approaches that would fall under the rubric of an archaeology against civilization. The program could be applied to any site or position where abjection is the rule. A factory farm, a slaughterhouse, a field of genetically modified corn, a prison, a landfill, a street in Pittsburgh where people temporarily wrestle control from the state. These are places where civilization averts its eyes, yet they're vital to its running, its logic, its destruction. We can confront the civilizing apparatus with the visceral evidence of its own putrescence, and then get to work dismantling it.